Steve Call is the author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. He joins us now from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I want to start with a quote in your book from the former CEO of Exxon, Lee Raymond, who said, quote, "I'm not a U.S. company and I don't make decisions based on what's good for the U.S." What did he mean by that?
Well, he's headquartered in the United States, but most of his employees live elsewhere, work elsewhere, and quite a lot of the profits that ExxonMobil makes are generated overseas and are difficult to repatriate. So they really see themselves as a global entity, sovereign and organized on behalf of their shareholders without reference to the government of the country where they happen to be headquartered.
But do they see themselves as representing American values overseas?
They do, yes. American, the rule of law, American business practices, best practices. Yes, I think in that respect they do, but not equating themselves with the interests of the United States government in the countries where they work.
Now, as you write, Exxon operates as if it were its own country. Give us a sense of the size of this thing and just how stretched out around the world it is.
Well, just think of the revenue is about $450 billion a year. That's about the GDP of Norway. It's about 3% of American GDP, roughly. And that revenue is associated with a pretty lean workforce, about 80,000 folks, and then a lot of the rest is contracted out. But they're spread all over the world. I think they say they operate in more than 150 countries, to be safe about it. And in many of those places, they're just in retail business or manufacturing chemicals. But in a substantial chunk of the world, they are drilling holes in the ground and sitting on top of them for 40 years at a time, which really involves them in the politics of Africa and Asia and Russia and Venezuela and lots of other places.
And in many cases, they have to deal with some pretty bad governments.
Well, this is the thing that I didn't quite understand as I started the research. If you're ExxonMobil and you look at the world and you want to own oil, it's important to understand their business model is they want to own oil and gas. They don't just want to contract to produce it. Then there's a limited number of places where you can acquire oil anymore. They've been thrown out of the Middle East by and large on resource nationalism grounds in that region. They can own oil and gas in the free market West because everybody can own property there. But otherwise, they kind of have to go to weak states that don't have the capacity to build their own national oil companies. So they end up disproportionately in places like Africa, which means they're on the ground in some really troubled places.
Do they have a motive beyond profit when they do something like that? Do they care if they're dealing with a really bad government?
I think they struggle to figure out what their corporate citizenship should be. And, you know, the European companies try to embarrass them by being greener and more forward-looking in the way they define their corporate citizenship in places like Africa. ExxonMobil's always been very conservative. We're not the Red Cross. We don't build roads. We don't build hospitals. Mm. We're here to pump oil, create jobs, provide profits to your government. We can't tell you what kind of government to run. And they've always been very sort of direct and unabashed about that. I think, though, the world is changing in this information age. Campaigners and citizens all over the world, even in really poor countries, have access to a lot more information. They have shared expectations about what big companies in their country should do. And, you know, the final point is in a lot of these African countries, for example, ExxonMobil is just disproportionately huge and powerful in the life of the country. A place like Chad, they were writing royalty and tax checks to the Chadian authoritarian government of nearly $1 billion a year. Well, the entire U.S. aid budget was, you know, less than $10 million. So if you're the dictator of Chad, who are you going to listen to? So I think in those settings, they haven't quite figured out how to be sustainable corporate citizens.
Let's talk about climate change. ExxonMobil, as you write, fought hard against the science of climate change under Lee Raymond, even hiring its own scientists when it didn't really like what other scientists were concluding.
Yeah, and they funded a lot of the most aggressive groups that were engaged in communication campaigns to challenge what was the emerging science at the UN and elsewhere in those years, right through the first Bush term and up till about 2006. Then Lee Raymond retired, and he was a chemical engineer of some accomplishment, really saw himself as a qualified scientist. So he said what he thought about the science and never wavered. His successor has said that he felt like ExxonMobil had a problem when he came in about its communication and its attitude towards public policy matters of this type, and that he set out to at least review it without radically changing it. And he did change their position about climate gradually over the next 3 or 4 years.
Well, you say review without radically changing. Where do they stand now?
Well, they now, first of all, they advocate a price on carbon-based fuels, which is unprecedented in their history. Here's an oil company saying, yeah, we should tax ourselves in order to incent a movement away from oil, gas, and coal. They are less certain about what the science actually shows, but they basically say, look, we recognize the risks are serious and the science is suggesting that they remain serious. So those are changes. I think they were in a position after the Lee Raymond era where they wanted to change their communication plan and some of their public policy positions, but they didn't want to admit that they'd ever done anything wrong in the past. Partly they feared that they might be sued the way the tobacco companies were. So they basically said, we were never wrong, we were misunderstood, but now we're changing our position.
How much of an impact did ExxonMobil have on U.S. climate policy? Because obviously they are a voice that are heard very loudly in the quarters of power in Washington.
You know, I think between 1997 and 2006, they really were significant. They played a unique role in the way they funded and led the American Petroleum Institute, the industry lobbying group, to take a very aggressive stance, challenging not just the Kyoto Accords, which were controversial and didn't have much political support, but the underlying science. That was the really aggressive tack that they took that a lot of other multinational corporations that didn't like Kyoto did not act that way. They argued against Kyoto on economic grounds, on fairness grounds, but they didn't challenge the science. And ExxonMobil really, for such a large corporation with such diverse shareholders, they really took a pretty aggressive stance in those years.
Are they heard in the same way under President Obama as they were in the Bush administration?
They're not. And they say that, you know, the Clinton administration was not a bad time for them by their account. I've heard ExxonMobil executives told me that they had as much access to the Clinton White House as they had to the Bush White House. Hmm. And because they didn't really see themselves as an instrument or an extension of the White House's foreign policy anyway, all they really wanted was to be able to talk about their issues when they came up. But the Obama administration, I think, has been a different kettle of fish for them. When the Democrats made a comeback after 2006, I don't think ExxonMobil was especially well prepared for that. And when they tried to adjust to the Democratic wave, they were really connected to the Hillary Clinton campaign, not the Obama administration. And so when the administration came in, they were really pretty well locked out.
When we hear leaders talk about oil today, especially with the rising prices and the fluctuations because of things that happen overseas, it's a very attractive idea to be independent of foreign oil, but it's an idea that it seems ExxonMobil does not think is a reality. What do they see as the vision for the future?
Well, they say about oil that it's a global liquid market and that pricing and supply is so integrated because it's so easy to transport oil that it's silly to talk about building walls and having a completely independent supply. What you want is an efficient supply that's price efficient. Now, the argument against that is that if you did have a domestic surplus of oil production like Norway does, like the UK has had, then it affects your trade balance, it helps your economy. But it's not quite the same thing as being free from the world of oil because you're still going to be a price taker. That is, if a war erupts in the Middle East and global oil prices go up, you're going to suffer just as if you were importing. So that's basically their vision of the global oil market. And I think it's shared by a lot of sort of well-informed market participants and governments. It's not so easy to translate at the pump where, you know, middle class and working class drivers arrive at a gas station one day and find they're paying 15% more than they were the week before. And they wonder, why did that happen? Because it doesn't really seem clear how all of these sort of sources of volatility in the market arrive at the actual gas pump.
It's kind of amazing at the beginning of your book to read about the Exxon Valdez spill, which, of course, nowadays has been eclipsed by the bigger BP oil spill. Do you think that these things are just inevitable, or should lessons have been learned from the Valdez that weren't, and now we have more bigger ones?
Well, the National Bipartisan Commission that investigated the BP spill basically said not enough lessons had been learned. And I think what the underlying landscape is that deep water drilling and transport in harsh climates like Alaska, this is really frontier stuff. It's like the early days of aviation. They're out there doing things that they don't have a lot of experience in. There's a lot of volatility and stuff happens. And when it happens, the scale of catastrophic failure, as with a plane crash in the 1930s when planes went down all the time, it's startling. And it'll take a long time before the sort of idiot-proof systems and safety systems take hold in these really frontier environments of oil drilling.
But it does harm these companies a lot when it happens.
And they know that they're basically their reputation is one spill away. So they concentrate very heavily on trying to prevent these kind of bet the company vulnerabilities from materializing. And you can see in the BP case, I mean, you really are betting the company every time you go out and drill in these environments, because not just the $20 billion settlement price, but the fact that you're vulnerable to takeover and that your reputation is takes a generation to recover. Exxon lived that. They survived it. But they're sort of obsessive about not letting it happen again. The question is whether any company with human beings in the workforce and the risks that they take in these environments can truly get to zero accidents. That's kind of the game they're playing. They are confident that they can do it, but the law of averages, you know, runs the other way.
Finally, Exxon is in a battle right now with Apple to be the biggest company in the U.S. by market capitalization. Reading this book about the leadership at Exxon and reading the Steve Jobs biography, you see two totally different management styles. How do you make sense of that?
I mean, I had the same reaction. I read the Jobs biography, which is quite wonderful. And you just think, what kind of a country produces as its number one and two largest corporations, Apple on the one hand and ExxonMobil on the other hand? And they're different businesses, of course, but the leadership styles really couldn't be more different. And they do reflect two sides of the American system. One very disciplined engineering and kind of management focused, that's Exxon, and the other very innovation focused and creative and California, which is what Apple's story is about.
But they're two very ruthless leaders in a way.
Yeah, and they have in common an emphasis on closed systems. I mean, one of the striking things about Apple and the Steve Jobs leadership style is that he did not brook open windows or a lot of outside compromises and partnerships. He did it his way, and that he very much had in common with ExxonMobil.
Steve Call is the author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. Steve Call, thanks so much.
Pleasure to talk to you.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.